Saturday with Katie Hannan on RTE Radio 1.
And it's Damien O'Reilly here for Katie this Saturday. Apologies for the little glitch in the opening, but we're going to get straight to our panel who are with me here today. Catherine Martin is Deputy Leader of the Green Party, David Cullinan, Sinn Féin Spokesperson on Health, and Richard Boyd Barrett, People Before Profit TD. You can text us on 51551. You can email saturday@rte.ie, and the tweet is @SaturdayRTE. But first, as you've been hearing this morning, the Green Party conference is taking place today virtually, and the theme of the conference is The Time Is Now, a reference to the urgency of the climate crisis. Catherine Martin, Deputy Leader of the Green Party and Minister for Tourism, Culture, Arts, Gaeltacht and Sport and Media, joins me now. Good afternoon to you, Catherine, to you, Minister. You're here in your capacity this morning to begin with anyway as Deputy Leader of the Green Party. Just on that, we were listening to the news headlines there and your party leader, Eamon Ryan, talking about climate and about retrofitting houses. It's taking place virtually this weekend, as you said, and you're calling the Climate Action Plan a pivotal moment for the party. You're in government now 18 months. The Climate Action Plan is now a reality, a pledge of 51% reduction in emissions by the year 2030. But for most of us, we see it as just another report. We're not seeing any signs whatsoever of actual implementation taking place.
Well, the time is now is our theme this weekend. And as we celebrate our 40th birthday as a party in the coming days and 40 years of activism, I think, you know, we are where we need to be in government. We committed in the general election that this was a green decade of change. And that is why, you know, not going into government wasn't an option. If a crisis is knocking in on your door, you're emphasising that crisis for 40 years, when you get the opportunity, then you must go in. And I think this Climate Action Plan is the most detailed and concrete plan ever produced by an Irish government.
It makes for wonderful and aspirational reading, but when are those demands going to come on us as citizens?
Well, it contains hundreds of distinct actions with responsible agency departments and, importantly, timelines. And Minister Ryan signalled today, and he will later in his speech, two significant announcements that will take place in the coming weeks. And that is, finally, we will be able to sell excess electricity to the grid. So if you have the solar panels on your roof, then finally you can get paid for that excess.
Well, that's a big if, and he's talking there about retrofitting.
This is going to happen, and also with the retrofitting.
No, but if you have solar panels on your roof, an awful lot of us don't have solar panels on a roof. An awful lot of us don't have electric cars. A lot of us don't have our house retrofitted for the simple reason it's just out of our reach financially.
And that's why the second announcement is key. And he has signalled that, and we'll be talking about it in his speech later with more detail. And that's that in January there'll be increased grants and lower loans for retrofitting, and that is another part of this plan that is coming into action, and we will talk about it in detail.
But those grants are not 100% grants, and if I want to retrofit my home at the moment, I'll have to pay at least maybe 14,000. If I want to buy a decent electric car that's going to do me a few years after the grant, it's going to cost over €20,000. Now, I'm not too sure how many people listening to us today have that sort of money lying around, even though they want to play their part in reducing the carbon footprint.
And that is why he's increasing the grants and he's lowering the loans. You know, the plan may not be perfect.
Do you accept that you need, you know, 15, 20, 30,000 euro in the first place before you can even apply for a grant?
Well, what I'm saying is that the Climate Action Plan, you know, you say it's not perfect, but it is a huge leap forward in ambition in what we need to be doing. And it means a huge shift in the energy we use, how we manage our waste, our housing stock,
But just going back to the retrofit, when you do the maths on it, and this has come official figures from the department, the average house will cost €56,000 to retrofit. Now, when people can't even scrimp together a deposit for a rent, where how many people in this country are going to actually be able to say by 2030, well, I'm fully playing my part in helping us reach the 51% reduction?
Well, approximately 400 million will be spent in 2022 on supporting people to improve the energy efficiency of their home. And more than 100 million of this will go towards free energy upgrades for low-income households at risk of energy poverty. So that is quite significant that we are doing that, and it's happening because we are in government. And I'd also say, point to, what we secured in the budget, approximately 380,000 people will benefit from that €5 weekly increase in fuel.
But what percentage of the population, Catherine Martin, do you think will be able to say that they can play their part in driving electric cars, retrofitting their houses, and maybe even changing to a plant-based diet by 2030 and being able to afford to do it?
Well, this is about, getting to 2030, and we have to do it step by step. So we can't just give up and say this can't be done. So we're trying to assist it in this just transition. And that's why I said €100 million will go towards the free energy upgrades for the low-income households at risk of energy poverty. Okay. We have that €5 weekly increase in fuel allowance. More than 320,000 children benefited from the €2 to €3 increase in qualified child payment. And we are working to deliver on this. It will cut emissions, create jobs and protect people and the planet. Yes, it's a huge shift, but it's a shift that needs to happen.
Yeah.
But with this plan, as I said, it will be assessed every single year to make sure that we stay on
right.
track.
As you said, it was a big decision, a big leap of faith for a lot of your members 18 months ago to go into government. A lot of your members walked because of it, but an overwhelming majority voted to go into government. Around that time, of course, you yourself ran against the leader, the incumbent, losing out narrowly. And you just look at the Sunday Times post recently, you're at 5%. In a time of a climate crisis, only 1 in 20 people have faith in you as a party to be able to, I suppose, help us along the journey to carbon neutrality.
Well,
an abysmal figure, really, isn't it? I mean, if you're not able to capitalise on the climate crisis, when will you ever be in a position, we'll say, to lead a government?
Well, actually, on 4%, we got 2 seats. On 6%, we got 6 seats. On 7%, we got 12 seats. And we have 3 senators. I would see in the next general election, we'll be able to build from those 12 seats. And the people see the difference that we are making.
Why is the green message not getting through to people? Why you, as a party, as you said, celebrating your 40th anniversary, why are you not at 20, 30%? Why are you not competing with Sinn Féin up at 37% at a time of an existential climate crisis?
I think we are, but we're one of many parties that are there for the electorate to vote for. But I think we'll be judged on our record in government when it comes to the next general election. And you can see our record just in only just over a year in government, the record of the groundbreaking climate action legislation passed by the Dáil. You can see the major steps were taken to end direct provision, a commitment that we secured in the programme for government. You can see the massive change in investment in bike lanes, footpaths, greenways.
But are you only appealing to a certain cohort, to the middle ground, to the middle classes? You obviously are not appealing to working class people.
If you look at other things like I've got an agreement over the line for a basic income guarantee pilot for our artists.
Right.
So for the first time, it's a signal to artists that we value you and we are going to give you that financial security to create.
Okay.
And as I said, with the direct provision, with the retrofit programmes, with the half-price public transport for age 19 to 23s from next year, we're just over a year in government, so judge us on our track record.
All right, okay. Well, you are minister, of course, as well, with a lot of responsibility. Can I ask you, though, you mentioned there about artists and entertainers, and a lot of those people are struggling now as a result of government advice recently and NPHET advice for us to cut back on our social activity, but obviously these businesses have to continue running day by day without any government supports now, unlike during the first lockdown. Are you going to reintroduce supports for struggling people in the hospitality sector and in the entertainment sector who are looking at empty rooms at the moment because people are not going out?
Yes, and there's no doubt it's a very difficult time, as has the entire pandemic been on two of the sectors that are under my remit, tourism and arts with culture. We can see just in the last 48 hours the quick, rapid twists and turns that this pandemic takes. And the only thing certain about COVID is its uncertainty. And I know that there is fear and anxiety there amongst those who work in tourism and with our artists, with our creatives.
Will you reintroduce business supports to get them over this blip?
We are keeping this under review, but we will do it in consultation with the sector. So the Taoiseach and I in the coming days will meet, are bringing together that hospitality and tourism forum. My officials will be meeting the arts sector, all the stakeholders there. And, you know, for example, just in the last few days, I've decided the 25 million euro ring fenced for the live entertainment industry. I'm meeting them to accelerate bringing that forward and to help them design and comment
Is that good enough, Richard?
No, it isn't. The PUP needs to be restored immediately for musicians, for entertainers, for taxi drivers, for people in the nighttime economy who have seen their work. The work available to them go over a cliff since the new public health measures. And I know I'm part of a cross-party committee, for example, with the musicians and entertainers.
I presume you support that government and NPHET advice, though, to people to cut back on their social activity.
I think we've no choice. Yeah. We've no choice given the current situation. And I think people have, without indeed mandatory requirement to do it, have on a voluntary basis.
Do you accept it's a difficult quandary for the government?
Of course, it's a difficult situation. COVID is a difficult situation. But the point is, if the measures that the government have to take in order to deal with the virus are going to impact on certain sectors, then those sectors need to be supported. And let's remember, the people who are hit are the people who've been repeatedly hit, worst hit and longest hit. The musicians, the entertainers, the nighttime economy people and groups like taxi drivers and others. And they need to be able to reapply for the PUP payments so they get some income support on top of the small bit of work that is now available for them. And the government have held out against that, despite being asked repeatedly to do it.
Yeah, OK. David Cullinan joins us from our Waterford studio. Before we move on indeed to talk about the latest variant, we have heard business owners and organisers indeed of the Christmas Pantos. We're into that season now, David, looking for direction and support. But I'm sure you would agree there must be a balance. That's the point I'm trying to make to Richard Boyd Barrett. This thing is moving at such a pace that we just can't keep switching on and switching off the PUP.
Absolutely not. And what people need is certainty in relation to all of that. So what we have at the moment, obviously, is a very strong public health message. I think there is still a lot of confusion in relation to that message, especially in relation to what young children should do and not do. I think it was irresponsible of the government to not have met. The cabinet should have met yesterday and discussed all of these issues, because late on Thursday evening, we had this announcement from NPHET. It did cause some confusion in relation to what exactly it means in terms of some of the advice. Is it advisory? Is it mandatory? What will the government do or not do? And when you have that level of uncertainty, I think it does cause real concerns. And obviously the PUP payment is part of that as well, because if the message is that children should not go to indoor play areas, but equally the message from government is that indoor play areas can still open, then those play areas will not have customers, and those play areas will obviously have to reduce staff.
Are you just complaining for the sake of complaining, saying they should have met yesterday? The guidelines were issued late on Thursday. They were well talked about earlier in the week. But the government will make a decision. The cabinet will make a decision on that in the coming days.
It's not complaining at all. It's asking for leadership. And it's what people
they have
are
to be considered
for,
so, rather than knee jerk.
Let me answer the question.
But you're looking for a knee jerk kind of response from the government to what NPHET are proposing.
Not at all. And over the last number of months and weeks, we have known that we have had a real difficulty here with this variant. And obviously with where COVID is at, we've had rising case numbers for the last 6 weeks. None of this is new to anybody. And the chaotic lack of planning, incoherent planning in relation to the rollout of the booster jab, for example, what's happening in PCR, and now what's happening in relation to income supports for workers, for families, and indeed for businesses, but also the mixed messages. It is not too much to ask the cabinet to meet to provide clarity, because when you have
at the same time, at the same time, David Cullinan,
if you let me finish for a second.
You had a good run at it there. At the same time, you look at the figures in the last week, if you want to talk about figures, hospital numbers have decreased and ICU numbers have decreased. And Paul Reid this morning has issued a tweet more or less thanking the general public for adhering to those guidelines over the past couple of weeks. So the government, in being very measured at a critical time of the year, telling us what to do, it actually has worked. Those measures have worked without knee-jerking one way or the other.
Well, first of all, I completely reject the notion that calling for clarity, calling for good planning, calling for wanting to see more capacity in PCR testing, calling for more clarity on antigen testing, calling for more clarity in what's happening in schools in relation to contact tracing, in relation to air filtration systems, which has not happened, the sense of abandonment that many teachers and principals of schools face, but also workers face in relation to PUP payments. You have your job, I have my job. There are people who are going to lose their job as a consequence of some of these public health measures. I'm not against the public health measures, but okay, if we are to put them in place, we have to make sure that those who will face a consequence and have their jobs lost get proper supports. And when that announcement was made, and there is almost a sleight of hand here, because we see it as well in the hospitality sector, obviously the public health advice is that people should limit their social interactions and how many times they frequent bars and restaurants.
Minister,
the problem is it has consequences. People lose their jobs and are not being properly supported.
OK, Minister, messaging has been all over the place and the government have had plenty of notice of cases rising and you have not had a plan or proper plan in place.
There's a couple of issues there raised. Just to say for those who work in the sectors that are feeling anxious.
Particularly the panto sector, by the way.
Can I just say that we will take the appropriate measures to support these people if required. I will do, and with the sectors under my remit, we will do that in consultation with them. And just to make that clear.
Can I just get a clarification on that? Does that include, for example, as I said, and we are specifically highlighting the pantomime sector because this is their one shot at it in any given year.
Can I just
and
say,
they're aimed at children in a lot of cases. Will they get special treatment?
Well, actually, a few days ago, I announced a scheme for Pantos. So we're actually ahead of the
method
advice
scheme?
Of this. So it's €2 million. And I will add to it if needs be, where the Pantos, commercial Pantos, can get up to 50% of their costs back from a minimum grant of 75,000 up to 500,000.
Okay.
So that is there already. And if more needs to be added to it, that is something I would look at. I would also say in relation to David's observations there, and, you know, why did we not meet yesterday? Well, leadership means, you know, taking the time to assess the situation, to take further advice, the data, the statistics. We can just see, as I said earlier, in 48 hours that we had the NPHET letter and then the new variant of concern.
Okay.
And it was all hands on deck in relation to that new
variant. Richard Boyd-Barrett?
Look, the public have responded magnificently to the call to reduce social interaction, and that is clearly having some effect, and that is good. But it then has consequences for very particular sectors. And the minister is not giving a commitment, and she should give a commitment, and the government should give a commitment to protect the incomes of those who will be affected as a result. And a couple of million quid for a fund is not enough. What they need is income support of the PUP sort. And we had to campaign very strongly, including protests by the musicians and the taxi drivers during the last couple of waves, for the idea that you would get a level of income support through the PUP and you could do a bit of work on top of that. Because there's not a complete shutdown, but there is a sort of 70 to 80% collapse of it for those sectors. And they need income support to carry them through this.
And Catra Martin, just coming back once again, parents listening to us now that have booked events for their children in the next few weeks, including Pantos, what is the government advice to them? Do they stay at home or do they go?
The advice is there from NPHET, and this is about protecting children. And, you know, unfortunately, the incidence, COVID incidence, is high, but it's at its highest rate, as NPHET has said, between the 5
so
to 12
So don't go to the panto next week.
I'm not going to comment on it right now, because I think that only feeds into anxiety if you have comments being made. But it's the government who will make this decision, and I don't want to feed into that anxiety. So I'm not going to preempt
people are cancelling their bookings. So.
I can't imagine regs being put in place for a 2 week recommendation by Neffert. They have said it's only for two
but
weeks.
Damien, that's the problem.
So
right
I can't
there.
Imagine regs being put in place.
Okay,
for
David Cunningham.
The public health advice and what the public health officials said was that they advised that children should not meet indoors for nativity plays and for indoor play areas and so on. And what's happening is the government is saying, oh, well, that's the public health advice. It's not what we're saying, which is precisely why the cabinet should have met, decided what the advice is. The government have to give the advice. Neffert advised government. And we've gone overnight from schools having been safe places, we were told, where contact tracing was not needed, to now seeing children having to wear masks. Obviously, the restrictions now in relation to children playing indoors. And it does confuse people.
OK, well, are you how confused are you, for example, if you had a booking this week, David, to bring two children to a panto? What would you be doing?
I want to hear from government, is that advice or is that mandatory? Because it isn't fair. On
would it make a difference?
Would it make a difference
to your decision whether it was advice or whether it was mandatory? Do you not have some personal, do parents not have some personal responsibility with all the information they have at the moment as to whether it's the right thing to do, to go or not?
I think people have done the right thing, Damien. The vast, vast majority of people have done the right thing and will continue to do the right thing. But I think it's important that we have a very clear message in relation to what's required and not put it back on parents and not put it back on children. If the public health advice is that this is a measure which needs to be put in place, that's a measure that needs to be put in place. And then you have to look at the supports for the sectors. But also that it isn't families trying to weigh up what we should do, what we should not do. I mean, as the Minister said a few moments ago, she isn't even in a position to say if that's something families should do. And yes, that's the public health advice that was given on Thursday night. And that's precisely why then we have this mixed messaging. We have families who don't know what to do.
Okay.
It's the government that are at sixes and sevens, not families. Families want to do what's best for their children. And I go back to the point I made. We lost all contact tracing in schools. We don't have HEPA filters and air filtration systems in schools.
And we've heard that now we have all of these additional measures.
To say, Damien, just to clarify a point
briefly,
there.
I didn't say I wasn't in a position to preempt
a cabinet meeting that's happening next Tuesday. It's very clear that Neffert feel we need 2 weeks to break the chain of transmission. And there's a clear message there. I think parents will make the right decision, as the public have done every step of the way.
Well, we're joined now by Professor Sam McConkey, infectious disease specialist and head of the Department of International Health and Tropical Medicine at the Royal College of Surgeons of Ireland. Sam McConkey, good afternoon to you.
Thanks for having me, Damien.
Can I ask you about this Omicron variant before we go back to talking about the measures we've been on about there? How concerned are you about this new variant coming from Southern Africa, which was discovered by experts in Southern Africa? What level of a threat does it pose based on the information we now have?
Yeah, well, thanks. That's a great question. The threat is based on genetic sequences and the protein sequence of this Omicron variant, which if we put sort of numbers on it, I know people maybe sometimes don't like numbers, but there's 30 amino acids. Proteins are made up of these little building blocks called amino acids, and there's 30 of them that are different in this Omicron variant from previous ones. Compared to, say, the Alpha one that hit us last year, it had about 19 different amino acids. Mm. So this is a more divergent, more different virus than, for example, the Alpha one was that came last year. But how much do those matter? That's the question. You have to sort of watch and see and study carefully. Is it spreading more in Southern Africa than other variants? Is it causing more disease? Is it affecting vaccinated people? And we don't have clear answers on that yet. It seems like the area around Johannesburg has a lot of this virus in it. Mm. Just over the last 2 weeks, it's nearly gone from hardly being there at all to be nearly the dominant virus in the area around Johannesburg. But could that be just one big super spreader event, or has that been genuine increased spread from multiple instances? We don't know that yet. Yeah. So I think there's a week or two of watching and getting epidemiological data from South Africa and the other countries to see that. I would suggest, you know, Irish Aid have a long tradition of helping other countries, and the countries in Southern Africa, like Mozambique, we have a long tradition of supporting public health and strengthening public health in those areas, and that's what we need to do is to help the folk there to see how bad is it.
Okay, and I think the issue in relation to the rolling out of the vaccine to poorer countries is an important issue we might touch on a little bit later on. But again, just getting back to this latest variant, the first we really heard of it was on Thursday, and here we are, I suppose, asking all the experts to try and give us worst case scenarios. Is it far too early yet? Or the fact that, for example, we know there are cases now in Europe that quickly, how concerning is that, or how concerned should we be?
I mean, when you hear the world... It is likely to come here, and that's why considering things like increased testing of people who travel from those regions to Ireland and to Europe in general is a really good idea. So back to even the self-isolation, staying 10 days at home, and really thorough testing of the folk who've travelled from there. Discouraging travel, now there'll be some essential sort of humanitarian travel and compassionate travel, maybe some essential business travel. So I don't really support the idea of closing borders completely when you meet an infectious disease in another country. I think the Australians told you can control the flow of people in a safe way through quarantine and testing. So I think getting back to that mandatory travel form that we all had to do and have to do, and ensuring that that's done thoroughly, and then that people who have been in any country where it is have testing and isolation until we're sure they don't have it is really a precautionary measure that's very wise. I'm hoping that this won't cause severe disease. Perhaps some of these new variants and other viruses are less pathogenic than the original strain. So we don't know yet. There's no evidence from South Africa that it's making people sicker. In fact, many of the patients there are asymptomatic. They're just picked up on screening. It could it evade the immune system? We've had one or two descriptions that, yes, it has infected vaccinated people who travelled to Hong Kong, but we don't know whether it's evading immunity more than Delta yet.
Can I ask you, based on what you're saying there, do you think that the government should reintroduce legislation for mandatory quarantine from anybody that has come from those countries in recent days?
Yes, I think that's what we need to be considering. Just like we did, we did it 8, 10, 12 months ago when we're faced with a new threat. If people are coming in, we really need to have a robust system that people are not introducing this and spreading it around Ireland. That may just delay it, but delay is a good thing. I'm hoping the vaccine companies will make vaccines against this new variant, if it is a bad one, in maybe 3 to 6 months' time. We could expect a booster, not boosting us to the old December 2019 strain of SARS-CoV-2, but boosting us against Omicron, and that would be a much better booster. If this is a bad one, a booster of a version 2 of the booster would be better, if you like. So I'm hoping that will come. The vaccine companies surprised us all and made a good vaccine within a year. So to do a new variant of it, a new version of the vaccine might just take, for example, 6 months.
Yeah, Pfizer indicates it can produce a vaccine against this variant in about 100 days, which is kind of good news. So while we talk about this, it's not Armageddon. And as Mike Ryan said yesterday, the sky's not going to fall in. These are going to happen. Catherine Martin, can I just ask you, what is the government position in relation to mandatory hotel quarantine?
That is something that's under consideration now. I think Minister Donnelly has referenced that himself. At the moment, the advice is, do not travel to those 7 countries. If you are coming back, whether you have a vaccination or not, you must take the pre-flight PCR and then you must home quarantine. But the mandatory hotel quarantine is something that is being considered now by government, actively considered.
Richard Boyd Barrett, I know in the past you would have been very critical of the government. We didn't move fast enough to introduce mandatory hotel quarantine. What about this instance?
Yeah, look, I mean, I think it's interesting that Mike Ryan has said he's against travel bans, for example. I mean, obviously, we have to monitor and find out whether this variant is worse, produces worse disease, or is more transmissible. That remains an open question at the moment. So certainly, I think we need more testing and monitoring of people coming from those areas to establish what the situation is. But I think the reality is this variant is probably here already, and it'll probably get in here.
Yeah.
And to me, what this is the chickens coming home to roost on something we've been saying, and more importantly, the WHO have been saying, is the disgraceful failure of the richer countries in the world to get vaccine to the poorer and less developed countries.
So should we be sending those vaccines to poorer countries rather than getting our boosters?
Yes, I think we should, to be honest, but I don't think actually it necessarily has to even be that choice, because the issue of patent restrictions and IP restrictions is limiting the ability of those countries themselves to produce produce vaccine. And the WTO have been calling for this, as have others. We've been calling for it in the Dáil for well over a year. And Europe in particular, including the Irish government, have held out against this.
All right, I'll
to protect
David,
the profits of the pharmaceutical companies.
I'll get David Cullinan's response in a moment, but just Sam McConkie on that, how important is that point in relation to, you know, none of us are safe until everybody is safe, that old mantra?
Yeah, I agree with what Richard Boyd-Barrett has said, that the Irish government has not actually really supported the efforts of sharing the intellectual property of the manufacturing of the particularly the mRNA vaccines with other countries. There are companies in India which have a really good record in making high quality pharmaceutical products, and where they allowed and given the intellectual property and the transfer of technology could manufacture potentially billions of doses of the mRNA vaccines, and that's not happening at present, and that would actually, in my view, help the world. Pfizer has, I believe, given open intellectual property for the small molecules, the inhibitors, the protease inhibitors that they've developed, but not so far for the the vaccines.
All right, David Cullinan, what would Sinn Féin do in this situation if faced with deciding whether or not to reintroduce legislation for mandatory hotel quarantine?
I'll support, first of all measures which are necessary, but I think we have to be measured in our response to this variant. We obviously need more information, Damien. Obviously, it's a variant of concern. It is concerning what we're hearing, but we simply don't know enough about it. But at the same time, I think it's obvious that we have to act as quickly as possible. So certainly I support PCR departure or testing, pre-departure of PCR testing for people who have to travel coming home from these countries. The travel ban on those nine countries is necessary. And yes, if mandatory hotel and quarantine is needed, again, it is an extreme measure. Nobody wants to put in place any of these type of measures. But I think if it's necessary, then we have to look at the legislation, at least put that in place and then be able to act quickly if this variant becomes a variant of greater concern. And obviously what we need to do is trust the science, to listen to what's been said. Hopefully it won't be as bad as maybe some predict it, but it is unpredictable, of course, and we just have to wait and get more information. But I do think that we have to act swiftly on the travel side, and the measures which have been taken over the last number of days, I support them, are the appropriate measures.
OK, Sam McConkie, before I let you go, just in relation to these next few weeks now, where there are going to be more people socialising, we are going to be introducing measures in relation to children and what they can and cannot do. What's your overall impression as to how the next month is going to play out? Do we need another circuit breaker style, maybe mini lockdown at some stage? And do you support the idea of children being, I suppose, enticed away from socially mixing with each other and going to pantos and sleepovers and nativity plays and all of that? Is that going to make a big difference?
Yeah, I'm reasonably confident that in the way that we've responded the last couple of weeks, and hopefully we'll continue to do so, that the levels of COVID cases and COVID hospitalizations and severe disease and death will actually level off, and then will slowly start to come down. And I do feel that through the behaviour of all of us, keeping our social network small and doing all the things that we know we should be doing, like wearing masks and staying in ventilated areas, that has been levelling off where the COVID journey is going. Now, it's levelling off at a high rate, and that's unpleasant for many of us who work in the health sector, and it's been very disruptive for lots of other areas, like a lot of schools. The children are off sick and teachers are off sick, and it's just really difficult having that degree of sort of snuffles and so on. Some of that difficulty is due to all the other viruses, and I suppose I worry most that the influenza virus is likely to come this season. Somehow last year we missed it. It never came because of all of our social distancing, but it seems very unlikely it's not going to come and hit us with an influenza annual seasonal thing that we've had for the last 100 years. And then that will likely put a lot more surge on the ICUs and the hospital system. So I'm cautiously optimistic about COVID levelling off and coming down, given all the stuff we've been doing. But I fear that the regular healthcare for people with appendicitis and trauma and flu will be difficult and very, very challenging. For the children, I think it's so important that children get out to play with their friends. The thing now is to find innovative ways of doing that outdoors, in ventilated area, in spaced out classrooms.
Right.
I'm hearing the teachers saying things that their kids are stuck in crowded classrooms and poorly ventilated ones. We need to fix those practical problems.
Get them outside, and that's the way to do it indeed. Professor Sam McConkie, we're going to leave it there, but thank you very much indeed for your insights today. There was a mention there by David Cullinan about PCR testing, and then Sam talked about how more of us are self-referring maybe for tests because we have sniffles or we're in close contact with the kids coming home from school because they have it as well. I'm joined on the line now by Dr. Nick Flynn, who's a GP and Clinical Director of Go Safe 48. Good afternoon to you, Nick.
Good afternoon, Damien.
You're running a private company there who's carrying out PCR tests to include both those that are symptomatic and have close contacts. Tell us a little bit more about what you've seen in the last couple of weeks. You're a private PCR operator, in other words.
Yeah, I suppose, first of all, to put GoSafe 48 into context, Damien, we're an Irish family-run company that has developed expertise in COVID-19 testing over the last 12, 14 months, principally PCR, but also antigen and antibody testing. We do see a lot of demand for our €69 PCR test with the same day turnaround. And over the last number of weeks, over the last 4 weeks, we've seen that demand has grown from, 200-300 tests a day, maybe 10,000 tests a month, to we're currently testing 1,000 patients a day, going up towards 30,000 tests a month. So what we saw, Damien, was that human nature was taking over. And initially, we had strict protocols in place that we were testing asymptomatic people for travel reasons, like in the workplace and for personal reasons. But recently, particularly over the last number of weeks, where the public capacity, the capacity in the public sector for PCR testing had reached capacity and people were waiting days and being sent, to Longford from Dublin, and in my own case in Cork, I had patients from the city being sent to Dunmanway, that we were aware that patients were booking in for private testing where they had symptoms. So we felt the responsible thing to do really was to safety net that. So we have to be careful where people have symptoms because, of course, symptoms can be caused by other conditions. So we built safety protocols into the booking system and our results process to ensure that people's symptoms can be...
Why are so many people self-referring to you now?
Simply because they can't access public PCR. So the initial system, Damien, was that to get a PCR, as the HSE were building capacity, you went through your GP for that. And that was very helpful for the HSE because it meant that their referral criteria could be matched absolutely. But then as they successfully increased their capacity, it was important that patients were able to book directly, patients with mild symptoms were able to book directly with the HSE, and that allowed general practice to get on with the other business that we had. But what we're seeing now in general practice is that because the HSE direct to public tests are under pressure and in lots of cases they're not actually available, that patients are coming back into general practice looking for tests, and that's using our capacity for other conditions that Sam had been alluding to. And we're also seeing then in GoSafe 48 that people are booking private tests.
Were you surprised that there were so many people looking for PCR tests and the fact then that the HSE wasn't able to cope? Did that surprise you?
I suppose I'm not surprised that people are looking for PCR tests because, in fairness to the public health message in Ireland has been very strong from the start of the pandemic, that PCR testing is the gold standard test. So, I mean, listening to the PCR message, I think it's understandable that the public would, when they have symptoms, want the test that they should have. And clearly, when people have symptoms, they should be having PCR tests. So I wasn't surprised. And when it comes to capacity, I think, Damien, you have to remember that there's three limbs to capacity in PCR testing. You've got your clinical swabbing teams, your laboratory or scientific processing teams, and your results management teams. And you need to build capacity in all three limbs. And at GoSafe 48, we've done that and we're doing it and we will over the coming weeks have capacity for 60,000 tests a month. And we would face the same challenges as the HSE in that regard.
Okay, Minister Martin, the government, HSE, NEFTED, everybody, the system has been criticised that we saw this coming and yet we weren't prepared for the glut in demand for PCR tests. How is it that we weren't prepared?
But it's the numbers, and on any given week, we have tested between 4 to 5% of the population. So like these are massive numbers by any health system. So some 210,000 PCR tests were carried out over a 7-day period, which actually means like one in every 25 men or women and children in this country have had a PCR test in the past 7 days.
But Nick Flynn there is running a private family operation. Why were more of these private testing companies not brought into the public system at the peak?
Well, we will be further. There's going to be a further scaling up of extra centres and extra hours, new pop-up centres, further private capacity scaling up. So that is happening.
But should it not be happening now? Should it not have happened last week when there was 700,000?
That is happening now, but it's just there's so many symptoms because it's the winter, and there's only so many people you can test, and we are scaling up.
All right, Richard Boyd Barron.
Look, with all due respect to the enterprise of your contributor, we cannot have a situation of two-tier access to PCR testing or have people having to pay for it or not being available.
Well, if people can afford it.
No, it's fundamentally unjust to have different levels of access to testing or treatment or any healthcare that people need. And what this further highlights...
But you would have a situation where people wanting to go on a 5-star holiday abroad would be getting free PCR testing from the HSE, whereas the system that was set up here by the likes of GoSafe48 were aimed at people that for various reasons needed a clear PCR test, maybe to go on a foreign holiday, not to be able to go back to work or get their children back to school.
Look, we are dealing with a pandemic which has shut down our society, has had, imposed immense hardship on our society, and we need to have the permanent public, universally accessible infrastructure, health infrastructure to deal with that and to deal with non-COVID waiting lists that are, you know, shockingly long, the overcrowding in our E&D departments. And we have a lot of that capacity in private hospitals, but it is precisely private and only available to those who can pay. And to my mind, this is the moment, and we should have learned this lesson from the outset of this pandemic, for a single tier universal system where we take private capacity into the public system and we have a single tier integrated health service. And indeed, we massively boost that capacity at every level. Our public health teams are chronically understaffed.
And I presume
our ICU is chronically low levels by European standards, and you can go through the list where our public health system is deficient.
David Cunanan, I presume you agree with that.
Yes, I agree with a lot of what Richard said, but just first of all, in relation to PCR testing and what Minister Martin said, I think people get frustrated when we're in the middle of a crisis and they hear government talk about scaling up. We heard the same in relation to what's happening in the hospitals. We had a winter plan that was published in the second week of November. We knew back in the summer that this winter was going to be particularly difficult. And listen, there are huge strains, obviously, on PCR testing. We need to beef up capacity in the public system. That means on the clinical swabbing side, lab capacity doesn't seem to be a problem. If we have to leverage private sector testing in the short term, that's what needs to be done, as long as there is a quality of access and is paid for by the state. But we need, in the first instance, to beef up capacity in the public system. And we're left here again, both in terms of testing, but also in terms of hospital capacity, having to rely on the private sector capacity because we simply didn't build in capacity into the public system. And I have to say, that's on the government. And people get very frustrated when, at the 11th hour, in the middle of a crisis, words like scaling up are used when the scaling up should have been done weeks and months ago.
Well, as you know, in response to David there, I'd say, you know, even the deputy CMO said it in recent days, there is no country that can ramp up facilities and capacity to test 20% of its population in a week. And that is what's happened.
But again,
and the HSE
having
going
a system in place to utilise at a moment's notice private operators to come into the public system.
If I could just say to the minister,
I'm just putting that point to the minister. Should that system not be in place where private operators, when we hit a certain peak, that they immediately are brought into the system to provide cover?
But part of the scaling up is further private capacity and three further centres through private capacity and at our airports too. So that is happening. It's a combination of the two. As I said, it's all hands on deck. But it's the numbers. As I said, we're looking at one in every 25 men, women, and children in this country have had a PCR in the past 7 days. But now that shows what is good about that is that the public are absolutely heeding advice and getting that PCR test and
okay.
know to
But it has to be,
Damien,
in capacity and efficiency. So take the South East as an example. Waterford, Wexford, Kilkenny, Tipperary and Carlo. For most of last week, people were sitting
And there was different parts of the country
trying to log in, spending hours on end, not being able to get through. And that's about efficiency and targeting the additional resources.
And up in Castlereagh, they were getting visitors from all over the country because they had loads of capacity. Nick, just finally on this, back to yourself, what sort of trends are you seeing, we'll say, in the last couple of days? We know that this was a huge issue earlier in the week. Is it still a massive problem? Is there still a huge demand for PCR tests?
There's still a huge demand for PCR tests. My barometer for that really would be that patients are still contacting us through general practice to access tests where they have mild symptoms, and we're still seeing patients accessing private testing through GoSafe 48. I might just say that I do agree with the points that Dave and Richard made about equity of access, and nobody should be disadvantaged from healthcare because of cost. At GoSafe 48, we have worked hard on keeping our price point low at €69 for PCR test, but we'd be very, very happy to plug into public health system where with agreed systems that people can access.
And have you been asked by the HSE to provide
Not to this point. I mean, we have excellent relations with the HSE. Like, I have daily contact with the contact tracing teams and the public health surveillance teams. And
are you surprised by that, though, considering that, you know, there is such a demand?
I suppose there's a procurement issue for the HSE, and you'd have to respect that the HSE have their processes and, you know, are doing, in my opinion, an excellent job to provide 210,000 tests.
But you have no contact or contract with the HSE to provide emergency cover, if we can call it that?
Not currently, although clearly we could have that, and we could provide that in a plug-in fashion.
OK. All right, we're going to leave it there on that. Dr. Nick Flynn, GP and Clinical Director of GoSafe 48. Just before the break, I want to mention that Grant Thornton had been on to us following last week's programme to ask us to clarify that the company operates a hybrid workforce. The majority of employees are working from home since March 2020. Since then, no employee has been required to work full-time from the office, and Grant Thornton, as a company, has not had more than 50% in the office on any one day since the pandemic began, and we're happy to do that. We'll be back after this short break.
Tweet at Saturday RTE.
And you're welcome back, and still with me, Minister Catherine Martin, David Cullinan, Sinn Féin and Richard Boyd-Barrett of People Before Profit. Now, truckers brought roads in and out of Dublin to a standstill earlier in the week, and hauliers are threatening to hold much bigger demonstrations next month if the government fails to take action over record high fuel prices. And whether you're driving a truck or a car, I think all of us realise that we're spending more on fuel in recent times. Minister Martin, Limerick TD Richard O'Donoghue is calling for the government to pause fuel taxes for 6 months. Is this a consideration?
I think it's important to point out that the spike in international oil prices is the overwhelming cause for that increase in petrol and diesel prices. Mm. You know, there's a cold winter in Europe, followed by the hot summer in Asia, that has meant that gas reserves are extremely low. But added to the fact that Russia,
it creates fuel poverty. Yeah, and we the geopolitics of it all is fine and dandy in that regard. But in relation to what we're paying at the pump, in relation to what we're paying to fuel our homes this Christmas and into the winter, is there emergency measures can be put in place there, such as a freeze?
The government has doubled the diesel rebate scheme to 7.5 cents per litre once prices reached over 1.43 per litre euros. And this is particularly targeted at the large scale diesel consumers. I understand Minister Ryan will be meeting with the Hauliers Association this week to discuss.
Now, is it the Hauliers Association or is it the hauliers that came to Dublin this week?
The Hauliers Association is my understanding. That
who disassociated themselves from that protest.
But that's who he will be meeting, and I think he's also looking at the Euro 6 diesel as well, trucks, to see how they can be incentivised or supported as well.
Richard Boyd-Barrett, did you support that protest earlier this week?
I certainly understand the plight of the drivers and people who are hit by fuel costs, who are just self-employed drivers. And that speaks to the wider problem of the fuel price hike and energy price
hikes. Is it the way to deal with the problem?
I mean, look, people have the right to protest. It's certainly a way of highlighting it. Mm. I don't think they probably gained a lot of sympathy for the particular way they protested. But the more important thing is to address the critical issue. And we've been calling from the outset that there should be energy price caps. And I think it underlines if you like, the unfairness of the carbon tax approach to trying to reduce.
So what would you do with the carbon tax now?
Well, we have called for, you know, for its abolition insofar as it imposed on ordinary individuals and householders who have no control over their energy usage. And that's what this energy price hike demonstrates is, you know, if you're in a house which is owned by the council or is private rented, you have no control over that, whether that house is insulated. You have to spend a lot of money on keeping it warm, which you have a right to keep yourself warm, and you should not be punished with energy price hikes or with taxes because you're just trying to keep yourself warm. Or if you're in a rural area and you need your car because public transport is pathetic and the government don't put enough investment in public transport, you should not be punished for that. So we need alternatives for people if you're asking them to reduce their energy use, and you need investment and funding to support people retrofitting their homes, which is totally inadequate.
Getting back to fuel poverty and the spike in fuel prices, and that includes home heating oil, David Cullinan. So what's the Sinn Féin answer to this?
Well, first of all, in relation to hauliers, I think, well, Minister Catherine Martin is right to say that this, in part, in terms of the rise in prices, is internationally led. The increase in the carbon tax has had an impact, and I think that could be reversed. I also think that we should look at the diesel rebate scheme and just change the thresholds to give greater support. But in relation to families who are experiencing really high electricity costs, I mean, what we're seeing at the moment is staggering, a 71% increase in home heating oil, a 25% increase in energy prices. And what we would do is give a zero rate VAT on electricity prices for home oil and gas electricity for 3 months. I think that's necessary. We're into the cold time of year. People will heat their homes more and need to heat their homes more. And I have to say, many people will be making very tough decisions because they have to pay very high rents, a mortgage, food costs, and now the rising cost of electricity. And what we don't want to see is people going without proper heating in their homes and fuel poverty becoming a real issue. So as a short-term measure, I think that 3 month zero rebate VAT on home electricity costs would be important.
Briefly, Minister, is that honour? Well, is that no, I just consideration want to, or is it completely
off the table? I guess I just want to correct or clarify an issue in relation to the carbon tax. So going back to the initial point I made, that it's the spike in international oil prices. And just to say that this year's carbon tax increases have added about 2.5 cents to the price of litre of petrol. That's 1/15th. Of approximately 37 cents per litre increase in petrol and diesel prices since January.
In rural Ireland and you're a trucker or commuting quite a lot, it can add up to a lot. Listen, we're going to have to leave it there, but I want to thank you all for joining us this afternoon. Minister Martin, Richard Boyd Barrett and David Cullinan. The producer was Mary O'Hagan. Research was by Andrew Fleming. Broadcast coordinator was Elaine Conlon and Damien Chanels was on sound. Enjoy the rest of your weekend. Stay tuned for Saturday Sport with Des and Joanne coming up after the 2 o'clock news.